Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, March 8th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to talk a little about the history of the 2023 film Wonka and present an interview with Wonka co-writer and director Paul King. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com. And joining me on today's episode, he is also a Slash Film editor. It's the Candyman, Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me. That's a song.
Welcome to the podcast, Brad. So I don't really know exactly how to set this up. I remember you and I talked about Wonka previously on an episode of this podcast. The movie is now streaming on Max, which is why we're talking about it again today. So anybody who missed it in theaters now has a chance to catch up with it. You reviewed it for Slash Film. I've linked to your review in the show notes in case people want to go back and check that out. I recommend that they do that. I guess before we just get into development history of this movie and some alternate casting options. Is there anything you want to say about Wonka that maybe we hadn't said in previous conversations?
I don't think so. I think I just would like to reaffirm that, like, because I rewatched it before I talked to writer-director Paul King about the movie. And I do think that it's for the most part, it's a very good movie. But I still think that it's hindered by Timothy Chalamet not being the best person for this role. And again, it's, you know, he does a fantastic job with emotional performances. It's not that he's a bad actor. I just feel like he has limited range when it comes to like the kind of characters he can play. And so even again, like I paid closer attention to like the moments when like he's supposed to be a little zany, a little kooky. And there's something that just doesn't ring totally true to me about it. Like it feels like he's acting, and that's not what you want from a character like this. There's never a moment when you watch Gene Wilder's version of Willy Wonka where you feel like that's not Willy Wonka, or that it's even Gene Wilder, really. You know, like he feels like a fully fleshed out character. And Timothy Chalamet, it was tough to like really see him in that form. And that's even like understanding, you know, that this isn't supposed to be like the Gene Wilder version of Willy Wonka. I wasn't even expecting that. You know, you want a little bit of change because he's supposed to evolve into that version of the character. But it's just, yeah, there's something about the eccentricities that don't shine through to me. As much as I love how he grounds the performance in emotion with the ties to his mother and those flashbacks and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm excited to talk to you on today's episode because I want to run through basically the entire development history of this movie. And as I alluded to, get into some alternate casting options, talk about some people that were up for this part before Chalamet ended up getting it. And I'm curious to know whether or not you think any of them would have been able to pull off that sort of transformation that you're talking about. So back in 2014, this is 10 years ago now, a writer named Jason McAuliffe wrote a script called Wonka that ended up in the top 10 on the Blacklist that year, which is the list of the best unproduced screenplays in Hollywood. And that script was described as, quote, a dark reimagining of the Willy Wonka story beginning in World War II and culminating with his takeover of the chocolate factory. So let me just pause right there, Brad. Like, does that sound like an interesting take on this story to you?
It sounds like it could be, but it also feels like unnecessarily gritty, I guess. Kind of like one of those slowed down versions of like pop songs that they use in movie trailers. Like this is like the movie equivalent of that, it seems like.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like, it's hard to think about what this would be now because Paul King's version is so opposite of that. Like it's so light and poppy. And I guess there are like very, very small touches of darkness throughout or something. But it does not seem like they used much from that script, if anything at all. So actually in 2016, 2 years after that, Warner Brothers announced that they had teamed up with Harry Potter producer David Heyman to make a movie centering on Wonka's early years. I think they had gotten the rights back from, or gotten the rights from the Roald Dahl estate and all of that. And this was only a couple months, this announcement. It was only a couple months after the death of Gene Wilder, obviously, who played Willy Wonka in 1971. So people like on message boards and comment sections and stuff like that were not thrilled about the idea of a Wonka movie at that time. Simon Rich, though, was on board to write the script. He's a great writer. He's written a handful of books, and he wrote for Saturday Night Live and was the creator of one of my favorite FXX comedies, Man Seeking Woman,
yeah, which I talked so about.
Yeah, great stuff there. So the names that I wanted to throw at you, Brad, that Warner Brothers was sort of bandying about at this time for the potential lead of this movie. All right, first up, Ezra Miller.
Obviously, Ezra Miller has a history of complicated personal issues and controversies now. But looking back at their performances, I feel like they would have been a pretty good choice for Wonka. They have an affinity for leaning into eccentricity, being a little bit awkward, and just knowing, having seen, you know, their version of Barry Allen as the Flash, I think that there would easily have been an interesting interpretation of Wonka there.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I mean, it's easy now to like look back and be like, oh, that would have been a disaster. But I think at that time, you know, 2018, 2017 or something like that, that casting would have made a lot of sense. The two other names, next one up, Donald Glover.
That's an interesting one because you wonder if they were thinking about maybe incorporating some of his like Childish Gambino hip hop persona into Wonka and maybe like updating it a little bit for contemporary times. Or if they merely saw his performance in Community and thought, oh, there's a bit of, funnily enough, childish glee and, like, you know, naivete in his performance as Troy. And maybe that would have been something that worked for Wonka as well.
Yeah, he also has like a little bit of darkness to him. And I think he can do that thing where he like, you know, does that sort of like wild eyed look. And I think he might have been able to tap into a little bit more the zaniness of Wonka, but yeah, also adding, you know, more of a darker touch to it or something if he wanted to, because he's like he can be a very serious performer as well as being, you know, super funny as well. So yeah, that would have been fascinating. And then the last one is Ryan Gosling of all people, which just kind of like makes the least amount of sense to me just in terms of age and all of that. He seems like way too old for young Wonka. But I don't know. What do you think about Gosling as a performer and how he could potentially match up for like a younger version of what Gene Wilder was doing?
I mean, there's nothing that Gosling can't do, and having seen more of his comedic performances in recent years, I have no doubt that something he could have pulled off. Take that into account with like his musical turn in La La Land. I would have loved to have seen what that would have been like. He definitely feels too old for the role. It needs to be like a much younger version of Wonka to dig into his origins. But I feel like it would be cool if like Ryan Gosling played like a middle ground Wonka, you know, like after he's kind of grown into the factory, but before he kind of like becomes a little more paranoid and eccentric and weird.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so in 2018, Paul King came on board, and at least one report at that time claimed that Tom Holland and Timothy Chalamet were the front runners after that. And obviously Chalamet ended up getting the role, but I was curious what you thought about Tom Holland as Wonka.
Yeah, Tom Holland, I feel like, has the similar appeal that Timothy Chalamet does. You know, he's got that young, bright look about him. Timothy Chalamet, you know, I feel like he lacks what Tom Holland has. And I would have liked to have seen Tom Holland in the role because, you know, knowing the comedic chops he shows as Peter Parker, knowing that he's also very skilled dancing, you know, he's shown that on many occasions. And so seeing him, I think, step into the role would have also been really a thrill to watch.
Yeah, the dancing thing in particular, I think, would have worked really well in this version of Wonka, you know, being a musical and all that. Not that Chalamet did a bad job with the physicality of the part or anything, right, but I just think Holland has like so much more of that sort of fluid.
He has like professional dance experience.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I want to say in your interview with Paul King, like he mentions that he still working on that. I want to say it's like is it a Fred Astaire biopic or something with Tom Holland.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be really cool. I feel like he's great casting for that if they end up actually, you know, getting a chance to make that movie. So, okay, I guess before we get into the interview, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, so what do people need to know about the chat? Why don't you set this up for us a little bit, Brad?
Yeah, so mostly it's about Wonka and just kind of digging into his relationship with Roald Dahl's books and the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory movie. And just kind of like the freedom he had to kind of play and really how the movie stands in like the overall Wonka canon. Because one of the things that both him and Timothée Chalamet mentioned during the publicity tour for the movie was that this was Wonka was viewed to be as a companion piece to Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, but not necessarily like a direct prequel. You know, it's implied that this version of Wonka could easily grow up to be the Gene Wilder version, but it doesn't necessarily mean that like they are tied, you know, narratively together. It just, they kind of borrowed elements of that version of Wonka, and like you could see threads that could easily lead to that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's some talk of that, you know, talk of the using some practical effects for, you know, creating the chocolates and the candy store. Also talk potential talk about the sequel that they're already talking about making. And then one of the things I dove into a little bit at the end too is because Paul King is known for also working on a cult favorite comedy series called The Mighty Boosh from the United Kingdom, which premiered in 2004, had three seasons, starred Noel Fielding and Julian Barrett. And it's very much like a Flight of the Conchords, Tim and Eric kind of weird, surreal comedy series with like musical interludes. And it's where Paul King really like cut his teeth filmmaking. He directed every single episode, and you can really just see like they played with a lot of stuff, and it's all these kind of like makeshift things. There's cheap effects and cheesy, you know, animals and that kind of thing, and it's it's a lot of fun. Like if I had watched it's enjoyable to watch now. If I had watched it during the time that it came out, it would have been something that like I loved and like turned people onto. And like it's I don't want to like reduce it by calling it like it's great for like stoner humor, but I can guarantee like if you know were getting high watching this, you would think it was like the best thing ever. But
anyway. Yeah, I've never seen The Mighty Boosh. From the way that you're describing it, it kind of sounds like Edgar Wright's Spaced, kind of like, you know, a showcase for a director to try a bunch of different things and sort of like, yeah, like get his feet wet a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because like it dabbles in a lot of like pop culture references and genre tropes and things like that too.
Okay, cool. All right, well, here is your discussion with Wonka co-writer and director Paul King.
Just to begin with, I wanted to find out, what was your relationship like with both Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and then the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory adaptation before this project came along?
My sort of gateway to the world of Wonka was through the novel of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It was sort of one of the first books that I read to myself, and I got this old kind of 1980s copy that I sort of read from cover to cover so often the kind of pages fell out, and I just loved it as a child, and it was a real extraordinary kind of one of the first properly funny books that I read, I think, and sort of certainly read to myself, and it's such a brilliant, vivid, extraordinary book that really captured my imagination and was the start of a kind of love of comedy that's lasted my whole life, I think. And then I sort of, as I was growing up, I saw the Gene Wilder movie, because I'm not as young as I would like to be, but that was sort of my Willy Wonka movie, I guess, and which I sort of saw through TV, and I think I sort of began to fuse the two in my mind in a kind of very, very satisfying way, and that was great. And then when David Heyman, the producer, sort of mentioned this idea of kind of doing a young Willy Wonka movie, I sort of went back to the book and read it again, and I'd sort of remembered how funny it was and how extraordinary the characters were and these sort of larger-than-life worlds, but I'd kind of forgotten how incredibly emotional it was. And it's such a sort of beautiful sort of Dickensian story of this poor, suffering little kid who ends up sort of getting all the food. It's almost like a sort of a Scrooge type story, yeah, or something like that. It's really, really emotional, as is the end of the movie, and that was really my kind of gateway into thinking, oh, this is everything that I like. It's funny, it's sort of eccentric, it's sort of larger than life and got these kind of cartoony characters, but it's got a real emotional core to it, and I thought, oh, that's something I'd like to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Now you and Timothy have both mentioned that you kind of view this movie as being a companion piece to that original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So I guess, like, do you feel like this is a thing where Timothée Chalamet's version of Wonka does become the Gene Wilder version of Wonka? Or do you feel like you've set it up so that the future version of Wonka as he grows up would be ultimately a different version?
I think because I sort of feel obviously that there are some differences between the Willy Wonka Jim Wilder movie and the book, but not very many, you know. And it was obviously an adaptation that Dahl was close to, even though he had, you know, he had a few issues with. So and I think because that was my sort of formative thing, I kind of felt, well, there's something canonical about that. And there are obviously there are choices they made, and I didn't want our movie to kind of spoil that movie for, right, for generations, I suppose, because it's such an enduring classic. So I felt that it would be great if our movie could work as a companion piece, and then ultimately 20, 30 years down the line, when the sort of Timothy Chalamet Wonka has grown up, he's sort of closer in tone to the Gene Wilder. I mean, I don't think either of us were interested in doing an impersonation or something that was exactly that, but more something that sat within that universe of Willy Wonka.
Yeah. Speaking of that, did Timothy talk to you at all about his inspirations for his version of Wonka? Like, if what kind of like performance he drew from? Because for me, I felt like there was a little bit of Jim Carrey in there, which would land with, you know, Timothy Chalamet's age and whatnot. But I was curious if he talked to you at all about how like he shaped this version of Wonka.
That's really interesting. We didn't talk about Jim Carrey, but I was a huge fan of his, so I wouldn't be surprised if some of that had sort of sneaked in. I mean, I know he went and watched both of the movies, but I think also because it's a very different time in the character's life, and obviously Willy Wonka becomes this reclusive character who we know from the book has sort of retreated behind the walls of the factory and sort of been hurt and sort of damaged in some way by all the spies and all that story, which is the kind of backstory in the book. That it felt like this was a period before he's done that, and I think what gave us license to make a movie with a hopefully satisfying beginning, middle and end was that we didn't have to end up with him sort of damaged and reclusive, right, which is hard to feel jubilant as you walk out of the movie theater at Christmas going, you know? People get really hurt in this world, mama. Happy Christmas, son. You know, it didn't seem like the most festive cheer. So I think at some point, I know that he watched them both, and you know, he's as well versed in Wonka lore as I am, but it sort of had to be his own thing. And because the character was at such a different time, we were able to kind of make a character who felt like Willy Wonka. I think the only reference I really pushed him towards as a kind of spirit of movie was kind of Frank Capra things. I talked a little bit about Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which is one of my absolute landmark movies, because I was really interested in a kind of a sort of idealistic character coming to a big city for the first time and sort of discovering capitalism. There's this, which sounds yeah, obviously a bit heavy for a kid's musical, but I was sort of interested in the idea that he arrives thinking the world is a meritocracy, and if you've talented and work hard, the city will reward you and you'll be fine. And then obviously discovers that almost everyone he meets is like a Dahl-esque villain who's deeply selfish and greedy, because the theme of the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory book is so greed, you know, in all its form, but it doesn't really look at kind of financial greed. And I was kind of interested in Willy Wonka, who's obviously a grown-up protagonist rather than Charlie, who's a kid, kind of going, well, I just want to sell candy, and then going, other people going, no, you don't understand, selling candy is not about giving chocolate to people, it's about making money, and if you stand in our way, we are going to destroy you. And that felt to me something that would sit comfortably with Roald Dahl's view of the world.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned too, like, obviously the Willy Wonka we know in the future, in the story of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, he's a little more eccentric, a little darker, paranoid. He, you know, he's been betrayed. He closed the factory because his recipes were being stolen. Do you have any thoughts on progressing to that eventually? Like, maybe doing a sequel where we see what happened to him in between, and then potentially leading into a remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory?
I mean, that certainly sounds like a I think when we started, we kind of were aware that if the movie did well, then that there could be an appetite for a sequel. You know, it'd be sort of very disingenuous to pretend that wasn't a kind of a notion. But equally, we wanted to make a movie with a beginning, middle and end, because you've no idea. And I feel this film does sit comfortably. I feel as you kind of go, well, that's its own story. And then when we pick it up later, we're going to learn what happened in the intervening years. But Dahl wrote loads of stories about Willy Wonka, many of which are in Charlie and many of which aren't. And, you know, he was sort of he was a character he kept returning to. So there's definitely room for more Willy Wonka stories. We know he's traveled the world. We know he's met, you know, been to, back to Lumpa Land and met Oompa Loompas. And so there's plenty of kind of meat on the bone to kind of explore. And I think now the film has done well, especially you sort of go, I'm sure there will be an appetite to see if we can find a story worth telling. So, yeah. So for sure, it's something we're thinking about. But it's also something where I suppose I didn't want to, referencing Timmy's other work, I didn't want to leave it like a kind of Dune is so much part one and it really is the first half, and you know, like, and that sort of seems the level of confidence that Denis Villeneuve's managed to earn, but I haven't quite got to yet.
Fair enough. I was curious, what was the writing process like for the songs? Because since this is a full-blown musical, they're obviously integral to the story and character development. So what was your collaboration like with Neil Hannon and creating the songs for the movie?
Well, we, it was kind of one of those things where I was interested in it being a musical, because the Jumanji movie was a musical and they got these kind of great classic songs. And I suppose when I thought about what I kind of, you know, the sort of first thought of what you remember from that, you go, pure imagination's probably in the first three things that people remember from that movie. And I was like, oh, this and the Oompa Loompa. And it felt like it would be lovely to sort of dovetail in with that. So I knew I wanted to use music. And music's really at the core of loads of Roald Dahl's writing. He's always writing these kind of bits in verse in the middle of his books because he's so irritatingly talented. He can write hilarious poetry as well as brilliant books. But and so when I was writing with Simon, when we got to kind of the first draft and there were bits of the script where we just felt, well, this would lend itself to a song, we kind of tried to write. We naively went, well, we'll just do what Roald Dahl did and try and write some bits in verse and they'll be hilarious. And then after about 6 weeks with a rhyming dictionary, you go, yeah, it's a lot harder than it looks, this songwriting business. But we did write kind of dummy lyrics for the script to help the read. And then once the studio had the first draft and they enjoyed where we were heading, we were able to bring Neil on board and he sort of took our lyrics and ran with them. And sometimes he stayed close, like there's bits where he stays really close to what we did and there's other bits where he entirely went off his own way and sort of wrote his own thing. So it was a mixture of things. But then we'd work on what he'd written. And so there was a lot of back and forth. But it was, I think for me, probably the most pleasurable part of the whole process, really, because it was entirely new. And I'm a huge fan of Neil's and obviously the Newley and Brickus numbers. And kind of, it's a good day at the office when you get to hear a kind of 150-piece orchestra playing Oompa Loompa.
Yeah.
That'll do.
Was there ever any hesitation about the full musical aspect? Because Roald Dahl famously didn't like that the original movie had what he called sappy and sentimental music. Was that ever like a guiding light for you? Like worried about that?
Well, it's strange because he definitely likes a musical because right. He wrote Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. So it was it's slightly hard to, I've always been trying to dig into this. One of our producers, Luke Kelly, was his grandson. So he sort of knew Roald Dahl literally on a personal level. So I was always kind of trying to dig into it, you know, what his issues with the movie were, because I think another of his issues was he wasn't sure about the ending, which to me is one of the great endings children's fiction. And so I'm never quite sure which bits. I think, to be fair, there are moments in the Willy Wonka movie, the first one, where the songs are quite syrupy and probably less to his taste.
Cheer up,
Charlie. But I can't imagine he didn't like them. Love it. I don't want to name names. But I feel the sick rising in my throat. Or at least I feel the ghost of Dahl having that feeling.
Yeah,
I kind of sucker for it. I'm more of a sucker for sentiment than Dahl was.
Now, one of the things I really appreciate about this movie, and it's something that origin stories struggle with when they're trying to do a prequel to something that's famous, is you didn't try to explain some of the more famous aspects of Wonka. Like, you didn't want to be like, oh, this is where he got his hat, and this is where the purple coat came from. Was there ever a discussion about trying to dig into that, or did it just feel unnecessary and you didn't want to have to worry about that?
I mean, it was funny. And we obviously also went through a process because it's kind of one of those things. It's kind of on a dial, I think. For me, I felt you want to understand a little bit more about where he comes from because otherwise, what's your movie about, I guess? You know, why are you writing an early story of Willy Wonka? But I also felt that some of what's amazing about Willy Wonka is he sort of seems to just kind of, he's almost mythical. You know, it's kind of like the way you discover him in the books is like he's Grandpa Joe's stories, and they've all got this kind of slightly apocryphal feel. And I think one of the first ideas I had was that he kind of comes out of the mist kind of fully formed, and he's a young chocolatier who hasn't sold chocolate yet, but he's already Willy Wonka. It was kind of felt like if we kind of had every scene where you kind of go, oh, and now I discover how vanilla essence works in a chocolate, it could have been kind of dull. And he felt to me more like kind of Mozart or something, and you kind of go, when I meet Mozart in Amadeus, he's not learning the C major scale, you know, he's already the greatest composer that you can possibly imagine. And that seemed a better end point for the story, and still would allow us to do a whole story. And also it kind of leaves some question marks, which I don't think you always want to answer everything of.
Yeah, absolutely. How much of Wonka's Chocolate Store was practical? It feels like you guys did a lot of actual set building for that. And what was the process of like making it all look burned down after the attack on it?
I think weirdly the burnt down look seemed easier to get than the kind of full chocolate look. It was so sort of atmospheric, that and the dust and the dripping and everything felt really great. It was a practical build, and we worked this amazing production designer, Nathan Crowley, and huge amounts of our sets were built. And I always like that kind of handmade feel. I mean, for sure, we're using visual effects to extend things, but we were never in a kind of blue blob just hoping for the best. You know, we really did try and build as much as we could. And it helps the visual effects artists as well to kind of have something to build out from rather than having to create everything. So we did build that shop. But then there are bits where we extended, like when you go right up to the roof, you kind of go, I think that the glass dome at the top of the roof is a bit of an extension, and we change things and sort of enhance things. So there's things where we use CG, but it's like the flowers are growing in one of the first shots, and we sort of had fully grown flowers that we then shrunk back down. So we use bits and pieces, but a lot of it's real. And I think that helps everyone. And that's a nerve-wracking build for sure.
Now, the zoo is a key set in this movie, and I wondered if you were tempted to sneak in any Mighty Boosh references in there at all.
I would have loved Howard and Vince to be napping on duty. that would have been very good. Yes. it's a slightly bigger zoo this time.
Yeah. speaking of Mighty Boosh, the series is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year, which is it's crazy.
And it makes me feel very old.
I was wondering, has there been any talk about doing some kind of reunion with Noel Fielding and Julian Barrett?
I don't think so. I mean, I've spoken to Noel a couple of times recently, and I know there's an awareness of the 20th birthday, but I'm not sure what they're doing to celebrate. But, hopefully they're going to finish that movie script they've been owing for the last 15 years.
Now, the series really feels like that's where you cut your teeth in filmmaking. And I was wondering if there was, like, any key lesson you feel like you learned during that time that still sticks with you today.
I mean, I learned so much making The Mighty Boosh. I'd really done hardly anything before that. I sort of directed some performances on this show called Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. But I didn't really know one end of a camera from another. And Noel and Julian just gave me the opportunity of a lifetime when they asked me to direct their show. And I think what was nice was we were all learning together. And so their sort of influence runs so deep in my DNA. And it's kind of all over the place, really, I suppose. I think one of the things I learned was they're such incredible improvisers. And it made me fall in love with the spontaneity that you can sometimes have, which is difficult when you've got this huge machine of a film moving forward and people have built something, or they've, you know, you've got one idea and you've really sort of piled all your hopes into it. But if a better idea comes along at the last minute, then you have to really embrace it. And especially with actors and performance, my favorite thing is working with actors who will make the script funnier than I ever dreamed, or come up with a line that I hadn't come up with, and to be open to that and work with that is a pleasure.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I wanted to ask, have you seen The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent yet?
Well, I haven't, because I'm aware that it mentions Paddington, and I feel I've just felt like I would be watching it to go for some kind of weird ego trip. But I would actually like to see the movie, because I love Nicolas Cage and I love Pedro Pascal. The only reason I haven't watched it is I'm aware it mentions Paddington, yeah, which is the most messed up thinking that you can have. But there you go.
Yeah, you're missing out, because hearing Nicolas Cage and Pedro Pascal talk about that movie is so great.
Is it? Okay, it's worth it, is it?
It's 100% worth it. And even without that, I mean, just watching Nicolas Cage in that movie is a lot of fun. I think you enjoy it.
Yes, well, they're both geniuses, so I don't doubt. I will watch it, but I'll have to do it sort of late at night on the TV with the window shut, because I'll be cringing with embarrassment.
So what is coming up next for you? What's the next project that you're looking to jump into?
Well, I don't have a sort of a go project yet. I mean, I'm sitting with Simon and thinking about Wonka stories, so that's exciting. And I'm working on this Fred Astaire movie with Lee Hall that I'm trying to develop with Lee Hall and Tom Holland, but we're just sort of working on the script for that. And there's a few sort of things that are kind of in development, and we just have to see what, if any of them, get good enough to go.
Do you have a North Star for when you get stuck writing a script where you feel like you got writer's block? Is there anything that like you go to, like a movie or something you do to like really help you push past and get back in the zone for writing a script?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I think there are various references that I go back to, but I think you probably want to find a different one for different movies. You know, for Paddington, I was hugely influenced by Jean-Pierre Jeunet and Amélie and that kind of storybook version of a kind of European city, which I thought he did so brilliantly with Paris, and I always wanted to do with London. And then Paddington 2, I really went to kind of Frank Capra a lot. Wonka, strangely, I didn't kind of have film references so much for, I suppose, because there was the Willy Wonka movie, right? And you kind of go, that's kind of your North Star. But so I think one of my favorite things, I don't know if this quite answers your question, but is to kind of, when you're thinking about a movie, is to find something you love that you feel might be helpful, maybe for the architecture of your script. Like, and we definitely did this with and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and Mr. Deeds Goes to Town on Paddington 2, and really kind of go, I love these movies, I love how they make me feel. I feel there's a kind of kinship with what we're trying to do with this talking animal movie. Obviously, it's very different in 100 ways, but kind of really dive into the architecture of how did that script work. And for me, it's like taking an engine to pieces and kind of going, okay, so what's Capra doing here? Why am I weeping at this point? Is actually because of something they said 20 minutes ago. And
right.
And that to me is kind of like trying to learn the trick of the magic of the movies, and especially how kind of emotion works. Different things for different projects, but right. It's not like I go, oh, now I'll just go and watch my reference book.
Yeah. Right on. Well, thanks a lot, Paul. They're giving me the light, so I got to wrap up here, but okay. It was great to chat.
It was lovely talking with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
All right, before we wrap up here, Brad, I just wanted to touch on something that you guys touched on there and follow up a little bit. What do you think about the potential of a Wonka sequel? And like, do you think, you know, you talked before the break about how this isn't necessarily like a full on prequel or something. So it doesn't have to like, they don't have to technically stop right before the events of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Like, do you actually think that they could essentially remake that movie and maybe there would be a story in between or something? Like, what would you be interested in seeing as like a fan of this world, I guess?
Yeah, you know, I because Paul King wouldn't necessarily say one way or the other if he had hopes of actually like doing a remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but there clearly needs to be at least one middle movie between Wonka and what would be Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, because something has to happen to him as a character to make him so paranoid and eccentric, you know, because we hear in Willy Wonka the Chocolate Factory that, you know, someone was stealing Wonka's secret recipes, and so he had to shut the factory down and kept everybody out. And at some point he recruits all the other Oompa Loompas to come work in his factory. There's all these little things we know that happened in between that you could have a movie that tells, you know, those stories. And personally, even though I hold the original Willy Wonka the Chocolate Factory in very high esteem, it was a movie that I have seen countless times. My parents had it recorded on VHS, and I watched it endlessly. I know it by heart. I love the movie to death. But in the vein of like Wonka and seeing what Paul King would do with it, I would like to see a remake that does carry over. And personally, I think the best way to do it, because I feel like at some point Timothée Chalamet is probably, even if it doesn't happen for 5, 6, 7 years, Chalamet, I feel like he's going to feel too young for the role still. So if anything, give Chalamet one more movie and then maybe, you know, get somebody else for like a version to play Willy Wonka as an in-between Chalamet and Gene Wilder. And maybe that could be someone like Ryan Gosling or something like that.
Wow, that's fascinating. Okay, yeah, that would be like definitely a sign of Warner Brothers, you know, putting the importance on the franchise over the relationship with the, you know, the people involved or whatever, which is like kind of a rare thing. But I guess it would be the equivalent of like a, you know, Warner Brothers version of Bond or something almost at that point, like making, you know, almost elevating it to that status.
Yeah, I think it's unlikely that they probably would replace Chalamet because he's obviously such a big star now and Wonka was a hit. So, you know, why mess with something that obviously is working for people? Mm-hmm. But yeah,
it's a cool idea, though.
I think that would be an interesting approach. But yeah, I'm curious to see, because since now that he's set up Wonka as a character, and the especially because there's kind of a lack of significant source material for this middle ground, you know, there are certain things that are mentioned in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator that give you an idea of Wonka's past, but they had a lot of freedom to play with those elements in the first movie. For the middle ground, they have, you know, room to do anything and everything, because there's not a book that fits in any of those details. You know, I'm actually curious, because Paul King mentioned in his interview that there are other, you know, stories out there that Roald Dahl did that like provide some like context for like what those things could be. But the only thing that I know of that for sure is out there is Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator, which takes place after the events of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and they like go to space, and like it's a weird weird sequel, and there's not really anything that fills in that. So I don't know if maybe he like working with like the Dahl estate or something like that knows about like unpublished like short stories maybe.
I think that's it. Yeah, I think I read something about how he, you know, went in and worked with them and was looking at like all of Dahl's writing and a bunch of stuff that didn't get published and little like, you know, notes in the margins and things like that of like ideas that he had for Willy Wonka stories that he never got to actually finish. So I'm guessing that's what he's referring to there.
So that's, I think that's where like there's the most interesting potential there, is like, is they could just do anything with the second movie.
Cool. All right. Well, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find much more about Wonka at slashfilm.com, and I hope people check it out now that it's streaming on Max. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe to our newsletter. There's a link for that in the show notes as well. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That does help us out a ton. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.